Saturday, January the 1st, 1966. That inescapable feeling of drama. What will this new year hold for us all? I spent the morning trying to settle Christmas gifts into just the right spot to add interest or charm to our burgeoning household. The wild turkeys that the West gave us, painted on the old board, I triumph. They're just right, hanging above the sofa in the little sitting room. And the Cram's cowboy picture, in the manner of Remington and Russell, is very good in the new cedar house. Lyndon was constantly on the phone, and I went upstairs to have that second cup of coffee with Tony and Martiana. Always such comforting company. And he had laid out for me the three artifacts which his friends had sent me from Peru. One, a glazed marriage jug with two spouts for the bride and the groom to drink out of, that had been used in some little valley of the Andes in Peru between 200 and 800 A.D. We planned a drive to Enchanted Rock, but just as we were getting off, Lyndon said, "No, wait for me. Go out to the plane and meet Tom Mann with me at 11:30, and then we'll all go." So we did. Tom had been on a trip to Mexico, a part of this tour de force for peace that's been mounted since the Christmas ceasefire. He landed at about 11:30, and he and Lyndon and Jesse and Tony and Martiana and I started out to Enchanted Rock. Here we have lived in Stonewall for 13 years, a little more. And I've heard about it all this time and never been there. Tom said in all the years that he had known Mexico and its politicians, he had never felt them so friendly to the United States as this time. I loved getting news of Tony Carrillo Flores and Fanny. Tony's enjoying his job as foreign minister. Fanny's walking again after her accident. But Lopez Mateus is a very ill man. The prognosis does not sound good. Our drive was constantly interrupted by the talking machines, with long calls from Bill and Joe Califano about reports from all the peace seekers and about the price increases in steel. Of course, the other five of us were immobilized while Lyndon was talking. It was a misty day, not one for exploring and mountain climbing. But as we climbed the hills, the country rolled away from us on all sides. Cedar-dotted hills and ravines and granite rocks and little running streams. Oh, joy of this year of 50 inches rainfall. And after about an hour, we reached Enchanted Rock, the largest granite outcropping in the country except for Stone Mountain, Georgia. All of us except Jesse stopped by the little stream. There was a concession house there and one bought tickets. We were the only visitors, and the people who owned the place didn't recognize us. As we walked up the great granite outcropping, which is rather like a dome, we crossed innumerable faults clearly defined, which made me wish for a geologist companion, and tiny little fissures through which life, never to be defeated life, kept on growing, little tiny yellow flowers, size of a match head, or maybe wee little cactus, and occasionally you'd see a small mott of dwarf live oaks that had somehow found a little pocket of soil. One actually looked like it had pushed the rocks aside in its growth. There were some interesting rocks, the Queen's Throne, others rather like Stonehenge. After a while, I kept on wishing Lyndon would stop, and Tony too, but there was no heading them off. Almost at the top, we came to a plaque which the state of Texas had put up in 1936, our centennial. The Captain John Hayes, who on Enchanted Rock had fought off and defeated, single-handedly, a band of Comanches in the year 1846. But we kept on and on going because the top kept receding. Finally, at the very top of the world, was a small, round, bronze piece that had been put there by the National Geodetic Survey. And from there, we looked off to all the horizon. One owned the world in all directions. It was a thrilling way to begin 1966. About that time, the proprietor, Mr. Moss, who must have decided who we were, emerged on the path not far below us, soon joined us, and gave us other interesting bits of information. One, in 1929, a car had come to the very top of the mountain where we now stood. Another, we were 1,900 feet above sea level, and at the stream where we had started out, we were about 1,400. He and Lyndon talked ranching all the way down. He's a member of the old Moss family, who've lived here since before the Texas Revolution. There were several Mosses who had fought in the last encounter with the Indians on Packsaddle Mountain in 1870-something. His cousins and kinfolks own the land on all sides, and I kept on thinking how good it would be if the state of Texas, or the country, owned at least this quite remarkable scenic attraction. I suppose this is another sign that we are a young country. We went home by a very back road, off of the pavement and sometimes even off of the gravel. Through Willow City, this was a day of firsts for me. I've seen signs to Willow City for 13 years and never been there, and arrived hungry as bears at the ranch house about 3:15. There was Winston, who had come to celebrate New Year's with us, and dear Mildred and the staff, and we sat down immediately to a delicious lunch, appetite is the best sauce, of ham and black-eyed peas for New Year's, and cornbread and buttermilk, and I realized the pleasure that comes all too seldom in our civilized, affluent life of being really very hungry and then getting satisfied. After lunch, I said goodbye to everybody and went in for a long nap. Though I didn't quite sleep, I read and rested, and then got up to see the end of a beautiful sunset. Really, Lyndon's last before he goes back. And then, at his insistence, we all trooped to St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church for Mass. He and I and Jesse and Tony and Matiana and Marie and Mildred. And to my chagrin, Lucy wouldn't go, because she'd been to early Mass with Pat, and this was her last hour with him before he went back to boot camp. Church was an experience. Everybody brought their babies, and there were plenty of them, several crying. Father Schneider's accent was heavy German, but we could understand the warmth of his welcome, because he expressed his pleasure that the President and the First Lady were there, and blessed all our party and all our work. With such genuine pleasure that I felt good we had come, even if my knees were paralyzed from the wooden kneelers. All this was Lyndon's idea. Sometimes I don't quite know what moves him. I think, in part, it was a gift to Marie, whom he teases so much about being a Catholic, but whom he loves. And I was glad, too, because Matiana wanted to go to Mass. And then back to the ranch, and there was Linda and Warry Lynn, weary, full of excitement, both chattering at once. George had flown in from London at 8 o'clock New Year's Eve and had left at 12 New Year's Day. Then Linda and Warry Lynn had gone to the football game, and they had left right afterward. And here they were. Excitement is a new mood for Linda, and it becomes her. She's looked radiant, happy, in the swift current of life, and I am so happy about her. And Warry, who is everybody's favorite girl, was beaming about it all. I had a call from the Boggs, and they told me they'd been wonderful little guests. Today was just what New Year's should be. Family, kinfolks, dear friends, nobody closer than Mildred and Jesse. The only disappointment was that Lucia and Burge and Becky were not with us. I never thought I would eat again, but Jean brought in the big turkey, handsomely decorated for us to admire. And then about 9 o'clock, we had the traditional dinner. No better dressing in the world than Zephyr's. Sweet potatoes with marshmallows, cranberry sauce. And then afterward, a session at the Johnson Bijou. Ship of Fools, which turned out to be a wonderful movie, though the audience gradually drifted away. Lyndon to sleep, and Winston and Tony the same. Linda Bird had already seen it, and Lucy went to take Pat back to San Antonio. But Matiana and Mildred and the girls and I enjoyed it.